It is hard to avoid the conclusion that Rabbi Akiva drew strength from his own remarkable life in approaching the future of the Jewish people. A man who transformed from shepherd to scholar believed that a people could transform destruction into redemption. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 104, The Origins of Akiva. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. In 1939, Britain went to war against Germany. C.S. Lewis, who had already served in World War I and knew of the battlefield's terrors, delivered a lecture in Oxford that was titled Learning in Wartime. Lewis addressed why, for those not serving, it was still important to continue to study, to seek intellectually the best and the highest. Some, he said, might wonder how anyone can focus on learning at a time like this. In response, he reflected as follows, quote, "Human life has always been lived on the edge of a precipice. Human culture has always had to exist under the shadow of something infinitely more important than itself. If men had postponed the search for knowledge and beauty until they were secure, the search would never have begun." End quote. Strikingly, the greatest teacher of Torah in the classical era was one who lived and died when Judaism and the Jewish people stood at the edge of a perilous precipice, the launch and the failure of the Bar Kokhba revolt against the Emperor Hadrian. Before we analyze this revolt and ponder why it was launched, we first, in this episode, must meet the man who seems to have served as the spiritual advisor, or at least supporter, of the rebellion, and, more importantly, the one who sustained Jewish faith after the revolt was defeated. This is Rabbi Akiva, the most paradigmatically positive, optimistic, and hopeful person in the entire Talmud, and one of the most beloved figures in Jewish history. He is also, as the Talmud tells us, a man who began life in total intellectual ignorance before becoming a student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai's students, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua, ultimately emerging as one of the most significant scholars of all time. Rabbinic literature abounds with tales of Akiva, and we will draw on them today as they are found collected in Chaim Nachman Bialik's Sefer HaGadah, a gathering of the stories and homilies of rabbinic literature, utilizing the English version, translated by William Broad. Not every single one of these Talmudic and Midrashic texts needs to be seen as entirely literal, but taken together, these accounts allow us to understand the person who believed that the Jewish people could overthrow Rome, and who, even when he was executed brutally by the Romans, nevertheless foresaw a time when the Roman Empire would be gone, and when Jewish families would gather again in a flourishing Jewish Jerusalem. Akiva foresaw, in other words, the age in which we live. We've mentioned before the psychologist Martin Seligman, who in describing the difference between optimist and pessimist, tells us that, quote, "Your habitual way of explaining bad events, your explanatory style, is more than just the words you mouth when you fail. It is a habit of thought." And Seligman adds, "It is the hallmark of whether you're an optimist or a pessimist," end quote. Optimists, as Seligman further explains, do not see setbacks as permanent and see them instead as challenges that can be overcome. In Rabbi Akiva, we encounter a man who awakens one day to his own ignorance and who concludes that it need not be a permanent condition of his life. He is inspired, as described by the Talmud, when he hears a citation of a scriptural verse about the power of water to wear away stone. Quote, "What were Rabbi Akiva's beginnings? It is said, up to the age of 40, he had not studied a thing. One time, while standing by the mouth of a well in Lida, he inquired, 'Who hollowed out this stone?' and was told, 'It was water falling upon it constantly, day after day.' They said, 'Akiva, haven't you read that water wears away stone?' Job 14:19. End quote. The rabbis go on to describe how Rabbi Akiva, hearing this verse cited, decided that if water could penetrate the stone, then Torah, compared to water, could penetrate his mind and heart. He immediately sat in a children's school and began to study. Thus, Rabbi Akiva's studies began at the age of 40 against a background of illiteracy. Having humbled himself to attend school with children, he mastered the Bible and then turned to the complex discipline of the oral law. Yet as the tale goes on, Rabbi Eliezer, who would later become his mentor, at first reacted coolly to the newcomer. Quote, "Then he went and sat before Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua. 'My masters,' he said to them, 'reveal the sense of Mishnah to me.' When they told him one halakha, he went off to reason with himself. 'This Aleph,' he wondered, 'what was it written for? That bet, what was it written for? This teaching, what was it written for?' He kept coming back, kept inquiring of Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Joshua. And the rabbis add, All the 13 years that Rabbi Akiva was with Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer paid little attention to him, so that when Rabbi Akiva offered his first clinching argument, Rabbi Joshua quoted the verse, "There is the army you paid no attention to. Now go out and fight it." End quote. Thus, a 40-year-old man, having never studied a text in his life, learns to read and arrives at the academy. He is ignored and rebuffed by one of the leading rabbis for well over a decade, and yet he emerges, undaunted, as a man of extraordinary stature. As I argued some time ago in an article in Azure, Martin Seligman can help us better understand Rabbi Akiva. In his book Learned Optimism, Seligman describes how his experimental observations of optimism began, recognizing that of all professional disciplines, the field of sales required a remarkable degree of willingness to overcome rejection. Seligman met with the leaders of Metropolitan Life, one of the leading insurance companies in America. At the time, MetLife administered to all applicants for sales jobs a standardized test that focused on intelligence and inherent aptitude for salesmanship. Seligman suggested, however, that a second series of tests be administered, geared not toward innate ability, but rather toward explanatory style, whether one approached rejection as permanent or temporary. Seligman ultimately discovered that not only did the optimists persist in the face of challenges, but the challenges actually encouraged them to work harder. The optimistic personality, in other words, sees setbacks not only as temporary, but as springboards to achievement. We may speculate, then, that the years of rejection only encourage Rabbi Akiva. Rather than facilitating failure, Rabbi Eliezer's dismissiveness ultimately engendered Akiva's success. Thus did Rabbi Akiva emerge not only as a brilliant student of both Rabbis Eliezer and Joshua, he ultimately became seen as the supreme halachic decisor of his era. But Akiva was also known for his faith that the Roman Empire would not last and that ultimately Jews would return to Jerusalem. Thus the Talmud recounts how once he and his colleagues visited the vicinity of Rome, hearing the sound of the bustle and might of the forum, the rabbis cried, thinking of Jerusalem destroyed. And Akiva, the Talmud tells us, laughed, explaining to his quizzical colleagues that one day the Roman Empire would be in ruins. In another story, the Talmud describes the rabbis passing the Temple Mount, seeing a fox roaming where the high priest had once stood. As the rabbis again cried, Akiva laughed and insisted that one day the prophet's words would be fulfilled, that grandparents and grandchildren would sit in the streets of Jerusalem. And the rabbis responded with the famous phrase, Akiva nichamtanu, Akiva nichamtanu, Akiva, you have consoled us. It is hard to avoid the conclusion that Rabbi Akiva drew strength from his own remarkable life in approaching the future of the Jewish people. A man who transformed from shepherd to scholar believed that a people could transform destruction into redemption. Rabbi Yaakov Maidan has noted that the verse cited to Akiva about water affecting stone was actually said originally by Job in a fit of hopelessness. As the waters wear away the stones, its torrents washing away the dust of the earth, so you cause man's hope to be lost. Akiva, however, in typical manner, allowed the verse instead to inspire him to hope that he could study Torah. To this, Rabbi Maidan adds, quote, "It was not only for himself that Rabbi Akiva drew hope, but for his entire nation. Just as the stone was strong and hard, so the Roman Empire was strong and hard towards the nations that were crushed under its dominion. But the nation of Israel was as weak and soft as water. And just as water flows from a high place to a low place, Israel fell from the elevated glorious heights of the Hasmonean kingdom to the abyss of subjugation and the destruction of the temple. Nevertheless, Rabbi Akiva maintained his faith in their power," end quote. This is an ingenious point. Rabbi Akiva applied the optimism of his own experience to the future of his people. Water to water, stone to stone. And to Rabbi Midan's message, I would add the following fascinating fact. We have just recently discussed the Arch of Titus, the famous symbol of Jewish defeat. Several years ago, the papers reported that the remains of another Arch of Titus, celebrating the destruction of Jerusalem, was uncovered at the Circus Maximus. What had happened to this arch? Why is it no longer here today? The article described an earthquake that had struck Rome, damaging that arch. And then the article continues, quote, "By the 12th century, the Circus Maximus, which once housed 150,000 spectators, had become farmland, and a new aqueduct to water the fields and supply the city was channeled through the arch, further increasing the damage," end quote. Thus, the moment that inspired Rabbi Akiva's own turnaround, the water that overcame stone, the moment that may have inspired him to predict Rome's defeat, that event has over the years been quite literally fulfilled. Water washing away stone, the Roman Empire washing away forever. This is the man who emerges in the world of Torah in the post-destruction world, the man who will support the Bar Kokhba revolt, the man who will sustain the Jewish people with his own faith at one of Jewish history's worst moments. For now, we must conclude by asking, What is the source of Rabbi Akiva's optimism? What sustained him through more than a decade of rejection by his teacher? And what was the source of his overwhelming faith in the potential of his fellow Jews to become worthy of redemption? If this optimistic approach was inherent within Akiva, why did it only make itself manifest after his 40th year? Here again we turn to Seligman, who notes that one's optimism is often linked to the presence of sustaining people or institutions in one's life. Quote, "The life committed to nothing larger than itself is a meager life indeed. Human beings require a context of meaning and hope. We used to have ample context, and when we encountered failure, we can pause and take our rest in that setting, our spiritual furniture, and revive our sense of who we were. I call the larger setting the commons. It consists of a belief in the nation, in God, in one's family, or in a purpose that transcends our lives." End quote. Rabbi Akiva himself was sustained by a commons, a context that lent meaning to his personal life. For famously, as the Talmud tells us, it was a woman named Rachel who fell in love with Akiva, and he with her. And it was Rachel who inspired him, who urged him, who encouraged him to study Torah. In one version of the story, Rachel, disowned by her wealthy father for marrying Akiva, was forced to sleep in a pile of straw. And the rabbis continue, quote, "As Rabbi Akiva picked the straw from her hair, he would say, 'If I had the means, I would give you a Jerusalem of gold.'" End quote. Here we find a reference to a phrase that will ultimately inspire one of the most famous songs about Jerusalem. "I would buy you," Rabbi Akiva said to his wife, "a Jerusalem of gold." This refers to a crown with an image of Jerusalem that women used to wear. Rabbi Akiva experienced the uplifting power of Rachel's love, as well as the power that stemmed from returning that love. For him, Rachel was his commons, a framework and context for his life that sustained him over the many years of sacrifice and study. And for him, Jerusalem embodied the commons on the national level, the covenantal and marital bond between God and Israel that could never be undone. I have just recently returned from a trip to Rome, journeying there with Yeshiva University's president, my colleagues, and my students. We stood in the Roman Forum, now in ruins. We stood at the Circus Maximus, now utterly empty. It was impossible not to recall the Talmudic tales of Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues. In the upcoming episodes of Jerusalem 365, we will describe another battle against Rome, the battle against Hadrian. It will last for but a moment in Jewish history, but Akiva's outlook is imprinted on his people forever. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.